Good evening. It's 5:32. This is a Thursday, November 10th edition of the KALX Evening News. Here's what's happening. An Oakland man is in custody tonight, charged with a rape occurring at the International House this morning.
The ASUC is broke. The Graduate Assembly has agreed to cooperate.
After months of searching, the Super Collider finally has a home.
And in sports, the awards keep piling up for a well-known Oakland A's nemesis. Good evening. I'm Peter Dudley.
And I'm Leah Ceccarelli.
These stories and more next. Man was arrested this morning for the attempted rape of a UC Berkeley student. UC Police Sergeant John Powell describes what allegedly happened at around 1:30 a.m. at the sixth floor restroom of International House.
The suspect hastily left the restroom after the victim began screaming and was chased down by several other residents of I-House who heard the screaming, and was held until university police arrived on the scene.
The suspect is Hisanori Wada, and he is being held at the City of Berkeley Jail in lieu of $15,000 in bail.
The UC Graduate Assembly said today they will work with the ASUC, their undergraduate counterparts, to end the ASUC's financial crisis. Here with the story is KALX reporter Jawala Karnick.
The Graduate Assembly is willing to help the ASUC out of its financial crisis. The ASU Senate Financial Committee has asked the Graduate Assembly to cut 45% of its $130,000 budget to help the ASUC recover from the present financial crisis. At the graduate meeting today, the bill was assigned to a subcommittee headed by Michael Berry. The committee will assess its budget to see if and how much money is available to give to the ASUC from its present budget. A spokesperson from the Graduate Assembly stated that some of its student groups have already been cut up to 37%. But GA spokesperson Aga Saeed suggested the ASUC may be able to handle the debt without their help.
Jim Angel, who's a Harvard MBA and is a graduate student here, is very strongly convinced, based on his professional expertise, that there are ways to get the banks to agree to lift their restriction without having to cut our monies any further.
Still, Saeed said the committee is willing to work with ASUC to come up with an agreement in good faith. ASUC Financial Committee Chairman Bill Buchanan said these ideas needed to be explored, but in general is optimistic that the ASUC and the Graduate Assembly can come up with a suitable agreement. Mr. Saeed also echoes Mr. Buchanan's optimism.
So I have good faith in our relationship, and I think we will be able to end this financial crisis.
Both parties express a willingness to cooperate to overcome the financial crisis. For KALX, this is Jawala Karnick.
Money grants from the ASUC will soon be scarce. Last night, the ASUC Senate discussed the setting of a precedent when it gave a loan of $500 to the Californians, the group that puts on Big Game Week. Senator Rob Vasquez cited the association's financial crisis as the reason for loans over grants. Senator Jeff Harris agreed, saying that the ASUC should only give money if they will be guaranteed they will get the money back.
Precedent of loans, is maybe something that we should stick to.
But Harris said loans often give greater flexibility than the typical ASUC grants, which ask the recipients to pay back the money from profits made during fundraising.
And when we give him a loan for $500, that means he can go back to his group and say, okay, we've got $500, but we've got to pay it back. How much are we actually really going to make?
However, Senator Albert Floor, a member of the Californians, questioned the usefulness of ASUC loans.
In terms of the precedent for loans, despite our financial crisis, it seems to me that the ASUC can only give out loans, and what's the purpose of having the ASUC distribute funds or sponsor activities?
But now the precedent seems set. Student groups can expect to have to pay back every penny they get from the ASUC until the association's crisis is over.
Apple Computer's gain is UC Berkeley's loss. The UC Education School is saying goodbye to the man who took the department from near collapse to national prominence just 6 years ago. Mark Brindell spoke with him.
When Bernard Gifford became dean of UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Education in 1981, a special campus commission had just recommended that school's closure. But Gifford attracted a high-caliber faculty and record numbers of students, multiplied grant monies 20-fold, and shot the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Education up to the top 10 in the nation. Gifford is now moving to the private sector, but says his departure will not cancel the gains he has made at Cal.
I feel that the Graduate School of Education is now one of the best in the country, and there's no doubt in my mind that it will continue to grow, and at some point it will indeed become the finest graduate school of education in the United States.
Gifford is leaving his $95,000 a year post for a vice presidentship at Apple Computers. Gifford will oversee educational computers from marketing to development for the Silicon Valley firm while teaching part-time at UC Berkeley.
I will continue to be a faculty member, albeit on a part-time basis. I will continue to teach in the school, albeit on a part-time basis, and I will continue to advise graduate students. I hope by straddling the worlds of Apple Computer and the Graduate School of Education, I might be able to enrich both worlds.
Professor William Rower will succeed Gifford temporarily, and no permanent replacement has yet been found. Mark Brindell, KALX News.
Merle Wu's grievance hearing against the university was held today.
Sewage system. Paul Connors, a spokesperson for Lawrence Labs, says the leak was too small to be alarmed about.
Investigation that's going on, but the radioactivity that we detected was far below levels that would cause anyone to be concerned about health or safety concerns.
Connors says the leaks appeared to have occurred in October 5th, 14th, and 15th. He says they weren't aware that a higher than normal release occurred until November 3rd. Connors says they did not announce the leakage because they needed to verify the findings. Connors says that the leakage was not detected because the radioactivity was far below the federally allowable standards. Connors says if their release was high enough to cause any health or safety alarms, their alarm system would have detected it.
We actually have in place a rather fine system, which includes education of our employees and also special manners of treating various materials in our various buildings and activities. And more importantly, we do have a highly sophisticated and rather unique monitoring system that helps us to identify things that go through our waste dispersal. Now, if the levels are below the standards set by the regulatory agencies, they're pretty much considered not to be harmful. And especially in these cases, they were so small that our automatic alarms couldn't pick them up.
Connors says the lab routinely makes 24-hour checks of the sewage system, and this was when the leak was detected. He says that they didn't need to announce the leakage, but they have an agreement with the city of Livermore to announce such leaks. The cause and source of the accident are still unknown, but they are investigating it. But Connors says, since the leakage was so small, it might be impossible to find out.
If you felt the ground move last night, that's because there was an earthquake in Northern California. At 9:08 p.m., the quake, measuring 4.7 in Berkeley, struck the region from Monterey to Eureka, stretching 120 miles inland to Modesto, with an epicenter 8 miles northeast of San Jose at the Calaveras Fault. The moderate earthquake could be felt throughout the Bay Area, but no damage or injuries have been reported. UC Berkeley seismographic station staffer Eric Collins says the earthquake was a natural aftershock of a June 12th Calaveras Fault quake that measured 5.0, but could be followed by an earthquake comparable to the 1906 San Francisco quake.
Well, there's about a 10% chance of a magnitude 7 earthquake on the Calaveras within the next 30 years.
Last night's earthquake was unusual not in its magnitude, but in its breadth. Few 4.7 quakes can be felt as far as this one was. Collins says he monitors about 10 Northern California earthquakes a day and many more around the world.
This year's encyclopedic California ballot didn't daunt Alameda County voters. They dealt with the 1,001 propositions the old-fashioned way. They ignored them, but selectively. On measures like 99, the cigarette tax proposal, nearly all of the 450,000 Alamedans who cast a vote for president also voted on the proposition. And the drop-off effect that some analysts predicted, that is, people getting tired in the middle of the ballot and giving up or voting no on everything at the end, did not occur. Prop 103, the Ralph Nader Insurance Initiative, and AA, the $225 million East Bay Park bond issue, which appeared last on the Alameda County ballot and needed a two-thirds approval, both passed. But voters skipped many obscure measures in the middle.
In the final semi-official election results are out, but many issues have yet to be decided. The few thousand absentee ballots that were hand-delivered to the precincts on Tuesday night still have to be counted, and some local issues are so close those ballots may make a difference. Mary Nitzbert at the Alameda County Courthouse says it will be a while before those ballots are counted.
tomorrow's a county holiday, and then we have the weekend. And then there are in the neighborhood of several thousand to be counted. Each ballot has to be verified, the signatures verified, before we count them.
The makeup of Berkeley's rent board is close, as are measures I and M, so the elections won't be finished until Wednesday.
California Secretary of State Mark Fong Yu, a longtime advocate of uniform closing time for the nation's polls, has called for the end of the Electoral College so that the state's voters will not feel left out in a presidential election. Yu criticized the Electoral College after network officials for CBS and ABC declared the presidential race over Tuesday night while Californians were still voting. CBS projected that George Bush was victorious at 6:17 p.m. Pacific time, and ABC followed with the same projection 3 minutes later. The polls in California remained open until 8 p.m.
The state Supreme Court has blocked a voter-approved measure rolling back insurance rates from taking effect. The court stayed implementation of Proposition 103 indefinitely to allow time to consider three insurance company lawsuits claiming the measure is unconstitutional. Proposition 103, which would roll back rates to 20% below November 1987's figures, was approved by California voters by a narrow margin Tuesday.
An admitted accomplice of a man charged in the kidnap and murder of two college students in 1985 says the killing stemmed from a risky plan. DeAndre Brown testified the scheme was to steal a car to use in a robbery. He said the money would then be used to bail a friend out of jail. Brown, the first witness in the trial of Damon Redmond, yesterday told the court that the robbery planned for Barstow never took place because it was deemed too risky. Redmond was one of four people arrested for an investigation of the October 1, 1985 killings of 19-year-old UCLA freshman Michelle Ann Boyd and her boyfriend. 20-year-old Brian Harris, who was a sophomore at California State University Northridge. Authorities say the two victims were driven to a secluded field along Mulholland Drive and shot to death.
Assembly Republicans announced Pat Nolan as the new minority leader. Republicans met today to announce a replacement for former minority leader Pat Nolan, who announced his resignation. Nolan's press secretary, Ann Richards, says Nolan stepped down because of pressures from an FBI investigation into alleged Capitol corruption. That's Pat Johnson, who is now the new minority leader. Coming up, we'll have national and international news.
Attorney General Edwin Meese. You're listening to the news on KALX, broadcasting from the University of California. It's a crime if you don't stay tuned.
This is Mark Russell, who is not the Attorney General. These days, the Attorney General is funnier. As a matter of fact, he's a one-man growth industry for lawyers. Over and out.
Air Force officially disclosed the existence of the stealth fighter today, which made its first flight in 1981. The fighter plane, which is designated the F-117A, became operational in 1983. Pentagon official Dan Howard said the fighter is ready for use.
A total of 59 aircraft are being procured. 52 of those have been delivered, and 7 more are in production. With the disclosure of the F-117A program, this mature system, which has enjoyed bipartisan congressional support since its inception, can now be fully integrated into operational plans and support of worldwide defense commitments.
The fighters are stationed at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. To maintain the secrecy of the project, the fighters had been limited to nighttime missions.
Officials in six states that have been lobbying for the superconducting super collider weren't thrilled with today's announcement that Texas had captured the $4.4 billion project. House Minority Leader Bob Mischel of Illinois is calling on President Reagan to review the Energy Department's decision. If the money is ever found to build the project, which may explain the origin of the matter, it would be the largest scientific instrument ever constructed.
As Democratic leaders met in Washington today, Speaker Jim Wright of Texas indicated that they are ready to cooperate with President-elect George Bush.
A good many things that Mr. Bush has indicated will be on his agenda, which already we can fully and enthusiastically embrace.
Wright also indicated that cooperation would be contingent on Mr. Bush's keeping several of his campaign promises, especially on daycare and the environment.
The changing of the guard is underway at the White House. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says all political appointees have been asked to tender their resignations, although some will be asked to stay on and help with the transition to a Bush administration. Bush went to the White House today for a cabinet meeting focusing on the changeover.
In a close Florida Senate race, Republican Connie Mack has claimed victory over Democratic rival Buddy McKay.
We believe that we now have that information, and those numbers indicate that clearly I have won. And so at this point, I'm claiming victory.
The race seesawed back and forth, but now Mack has an edge with only a small number of absentee ballots to be counted. Now he says it's time to look to the future.
It has been a tough race. I've expressed my feelings, my ideas. A buddy did the same, and the people of Florida have chosen. And now it's time for me to extend my hand of unity to throughout the state and say that I'm going to work hard for all Floridians.
Mack has been a senator representing Southwest Florida in Congress since 1982.
The FBI is looking at whether crimes were committed when a computer virus was introduced into national computer networks. FBI Director William Sessions says the Bureau is studying a wide range of possible violations, including wire fraud, malicious mischief, and unlawful access to stored communications. A Cornell University student has told friends he wrote the program, which spread like a virus and disabled thousands of computers nationwide last week.
Milwaukee fire officials say the bodies of two workmen have been located following an explosion in a sewer tunnel. One other worker is missing. The three were caught while checking explosive methane gas levels in the tunnel, which was under construction.
In Sri Lanka, there are reports that 15 people were shot in anti-government demonstrations in the south of the country, the heartland of an extreme people's liberation movement called the JVP. They say the government of President Jirwanda is illegal because it hasn't called a general election in 11 years. The BBC's Chris Nuttall reports.
This was the worst day of clashes between the security forces and demonstrators during the present unrest in the Sinhalese majority areas of the country. Some of the protests were in defiance of a 34-hour local curfew. The government had warned that troops had been given permission to shoot on sight anyone taking part in demonstrations or violating curfews. Police opened fire, killing six people in a crowd of 2,000 protesting against the government in the southern district of Hambantota, about 120 miles southeast of Colombo. Five more people were shot dead when a crowd of 1,500 staged a protest in the same area. Also in the south, troops killed four people when a group stormed an army truck. More than 20 people, including several soldiers, were injured in the clashes. A house of the chief minister of the southern province was set on fire. The security situation in Sri Lanka has been deteriorating, with nightly island-wide curfews now being declared to prevent JVP violence. The JVP has been bringing the country to a halt over the past few days with its strike calls. Transport has been crippled, there are food shortages, and shops, banks, and offices have been closed. President Jayawardena has said he will dissolve Parliament if the JVP agrees to give up its campaign of disruption and violence.
That was the BBC's Chris Nuttall.
Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega announced late Wednesday that his country would like to offer U.S. President-elect George Bush a new proposal for the normalization of relations with the U.S. and a resumption of negotiations with the Nicaraguan resistance and contra-military leaders. Nicaraguan anti-government groups insist that a political dialogue is not likely as long as the Sandinistas continue to jail opposition leaders. Ronnie Ludner is in Managua with a report.
The group was arrested in mid-July after Sandinista police broke up what most observers say was a peaceful demonstration in the Nicaraguan town of Nandaime with tear gas and clubbings. At the same time, the Sandinistas expelled the U.S. ambassador. Judicial proceedings against the group have been ongoing since their arrest, but they remain in jail because under Nicaraguan law, there is no such thing as bail. They are charged with inciting to riot and disturbing the peace. Although most observers insist it was an overreaction by the Sandinista police to one of the few sizable opposition protests ever to occur that caused the violence. Yet after U.S. House Speaker Jim Wright charged that the CIA had sponsored anti-government protests to provoke the Sandinistas, the Nicaraguan government has felt justified in its decision to muzzle the opposition here. In fact, no other demonstrations have been allowed since the Nandaime protest incident. The opposition newspaper La Prensa refers to them as the heroes of Nandaime and now includes a daily column that features the pictures of the five most prominent arrestees and a countdown of how many days they have been jailed. I'm Ronnie Loveler in Managua.
KALX News Time is 5:55. Coming up in sports, a strange result in the Nabisco Golf Tournament, while the Cy Young Award winner is not a surprise at all. Dave Martinez is up next.
Scoop Nisker guest co-anchor saying if you don't like the news on Calix, you have no other choice but to go out and make some of your own.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to sports. This is Dave Martinez. Well, to no one's surprise, World Series hero Oral Hershiser today became the fifth Dodger pitcher to win the prestigious Cy Young Award. The Baseball Writers Association of America unanimously voted him the winner, placing him number one on all 24 ballots. Danny Jackson of the Cincinnati Reds came in second, and New York's David Cone in third. Hershiser finished the regular season at 23-8 with a 2.26 ERA, but what clinched the award for him was setting a record with 59 consecutive scoreless innings. He continued his dominance in the postseason, pitching two shutouts and winning both the National League Championship Series and World Series MVP awards. Hershiser follows in a long line of great Dodger pitchers who have won Cy Young Awards, including Don Newcomb, Don Drysdale, Sandy Koufax, who won it three times, Mike Marshall, the relief pitcher, and Fernando Valenzuela. Yesterday, of course, Frank Viola of the Minnesota Twins won the American League Award, placing first on 27 of 28 ballots. Oakland reliever Dennis Eckersley came in second. Well, there's not much happening in Cal sports, but don't tell that to the women's volleyball team, which is preparing for a big weekend. Here's KALX's Venus Stromberg with the details.
Volleyball action abounds this weekend at Harmon Gym. The number 19 Cal volleyball team plays its last weekend series at home against Oregon and Oregon State. The Bears have enjoyed much success against these teams and expect to continue this trend. Cal plays Oregon on Friday night, and although this will be the tougher of the two teams, the Bears' Tracy Krueger is certain her team can pull together and defeat them.
It's always working together as a team, and that's how we beat them last time, tough serving and defense.
Against Oregon State, Cal has a 13-1 all-time record, but Krueger knows they can't take this for granted when they face them on Saturday.
Oregon State isn't as strong as University of Oregon, but we will still have to push really hard because if we slack off, then it's really easy to lose the game.
Fridays and Saturdays games start at 7:30 at Harmon. For KALX Sports, I'm Venus Stromberg.
Another team looking toward a big weekend is the women's soccer team. After their 2-0 victory over St. Mary's in the first round of the NCAA playoffs last weekend, the Golden Bears traveled to the Mile High State to take on third-ranked Colorado College in the quarterfinals. Cal, ranked 7th in the nation, will have to play without sweeper Andrea Archer, who will undergo surgery on her injured knee on Tuesday. Well, I usually don't report on golf, but what the hell. Curtis Strange lit up the Pebble Beach Golf Links to grab a three-shot lead after one round of the Nabisco Championship. An 8-under-par 64 put last year's U.S. Open champ in front of Ken Green, who finished at 67, and Joey Sindelar, who posted a 68. The group tied at 69 included Bruce Litsky, Bob Tway, Jay Haas, and Scott Verplank. Sandy Lyle of Scotland had an even par 72, while Greg Norman from Down Under closed with a pair of double bogeys en route to a 75. Well, like Cal Sports, the NBA has an abbreviated schedule with only two games on the docket tonight. The 1-1 Utah Jazz take on the 1-2 Rockets at Houston in a Midwest division battle, while the undefeated Portland Trailblazers, they're only 2-0, travel to Denver to take on the 1-2 Nuggets. And one final note, the agent for Carl Lewis says he's been approached by an advisor to Ben Johnson about staging a lucrative race between the two sprinters. Lewis's agent remains cautious, however, in the wake of Johnson's banishment from international track meets because of his well-publicized positive drug test at the Seoul Olympics. Lewis wants to make sure his status is not endangered if he races Johnson. And that's a look at the world of sports. I am Dave Martinez.
Thank you. And now for a bit of weather. Tonight is predicted to be, it's supposed to clear and get a little cooler with patchy fog developing and getting a little denser around sunrise. The temperatures should be between 45 and 50, and the wind should become about 20 miles per hour from the west. On Friday, there will be patchy clouds and local dense morning fog. Otherwise, partly sunny. The highs will be 60 to 65. On Saturday, there will be morning clouds and fog with a 20% chance of rain, then partial afternoon clearing. Highs will be from the upper 50s to the mid-60s.
And that's all for tonight's newscast. Special thanks to engineer Scott Brody. Remember to tune in every morning at 8 a.m., afternoon at noon, and night at 5:30 for all the latest in national, international, and, of course, local news. I'm Leah Ciccarelli.
And I'm Peter Dudley.
Good night.